This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you were listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, we ordinarily would ask you to hold your calls, but apparently we're going to have some difficulty with our guests this evening. We've been trying to reach them all day, and all we got was an answering machine, and that's just what we've got right now is an answering machine. So, If you are out there in the listening audience, you'd like to give us a call. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And if you don't call in, why, we're going to have to just, you're going to have to listen to a monologue that is totally unrehearsed. But as long as we have a few minutes, let me talk a little bit about the program I saw last evening. It was on 60 Minutes, and it was an interview with Jane Fonda. And Jane is in her 60s now, still a very attractive woman, and talking about her life, which has just been a tragic, tragic life of three marriages, and at least the first one she discussed in a great deal of detail, and it sounded pretty terrible. And then her marriage to Tom Hayden, and then, of course, to Ted Turner. But she talked about her attitude towards the Vietnam War. And I thought this was really so important. Now, she apologized for sitting on the anti-aircraft battery there, and but she didn't apologize for going to North Vietnam. She didn't apologize for opposing the war. She didn't apologize for making announcements over North Vietnamese radio. And all those things, she was wrong, except in the fact that she opposed the Vietnam War. Now, as with so many young people at that time, she opposed the Vietnam War for all the wrong reasons. She was right to oppose the war, but unfortunately, most of the anti-war movement was financed by the communists, who were in turn financed by the establishment, who wanted a controlled opposition because the Vietnam War was a phony war. If we ask the average American today, how many people died in the Vietnam War? What would the response be? What your response would be if I were to ask you that question? How many people died in the Vietnam War? You'd probably say 58,000. Why would you say 58,000? Well, because that's what you're told over and over again. Well, yes, 58,000 Americans didn't come home from the war. Many of those were abandoned. There were several thousand that were abandoned in Vietnam, and others that are not even listed that were abandoned in Laos, who worked for the Central Intelligence Agency or other parts of the dark side of our government. But there were 3 million Vietnamese who were slaughtered there, 1 million South Vietnamese and 2 million North Vietnamese, and of course we turned a lot of the North Vietnam into a rubble. We bombed lots of areas of Hanoi, and then every time we'd just about get to the point where they were ready to surrender, why we'd stop our bombing, because we wanted the war to go on. We could have stopped the war at any time. We could have simply bombed the hydroelectric plant up there, shut off all the electricity, stopped all commerce, and that would have ended the war. We could have bombed the dikes and flooded North Vietnam. We were never allowed to do that. We were never allowed to bomb the rail lines or to mine the harbor in Haiphong. We were never allowed to do anything to end the war, because, you see, We weren't there to fight communism. We were there to divert the attention of the American people from what was going on here in the United States, because Vietnam was really intended to be used as a vehicle of changing the United States. And I'm going to tell you how I can make that statement, which most people, of course, have no idea what's really going on or why we went to Vietnam, because we certainly weren't fighting communism. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our regularly scheduled guest, did not appear, so you're going to just have to put up with me unless you call in here, or you'd like, of course, to talk a little bit about the things we're talking about. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. We're out across America at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But if you go into the background of what really happened at that time, of course, when the war started, I was a steadfast anti-communist. I believe, as we were all told, that communism threatened the stability of the world. That at that time, about a quarter of the people in the world lived under communism, a third of the landmass of the world was under communism. Communism was on the march throughout the world, and there was a very real threat that they were going to take over the world. Now, what I didn't understand is that communism is and always has been a failure. It just doesn't work. It never would have survived had it not been for constant infusions of technology and funding and help from the Western world, in fact, primarily from the United States and Great Britain. I mean, at that time, I'd never read the writings of Bruce Lockhart, who'd been in Moscow in 1918. It was actually sent there by a man named Lord Milner, who was the head of a secret society, led this Cecil Rhodes secret society after Cecil Rhodes died. And Bruce Lockhart, in his book, British Agent, tells how here he is. He's in Moscow. There's been a revolution. There's a dictator. His name is Lenin. But before Lenin does anything, he always comes to check with Bruce Lockhart, with the fellows writing the book, and with the representative, Mr. Thompson, from the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C. In fact, Lenin does just anything they ask him to. Lenin is totally subservient to these people, and Lockhart just doesn't understand it. He's there. He's been sent to keep Lord Milner appraised of what's going on in Russia, but he doesn't understand why the communists are so intent upon inviting he and the representative of the American Federal Reserve System into their secret meetings as they're planning on how they're going to consolidate their control. And, of course, at that time, why the Hoover Mission was giving massive supplies to the communists and absolutely no supplies to the anti-communists. And once again, we see an example of the best enemy that money could buy. And the great tragedy of modern times is that most people have no idea that communism would have simply faded away had it not been for constant infusion of money and aid and technology from the Western governments. In fact, the Vietnam War would have ended much within a few months had we not constantly financed the enemy. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and we're simply talking about Vietnam. But you can't look at Vietnam unless you understand the background to the world communist movement. And, of course, in 1962 is when I really got involved in this whole incredible movement that changed my life and has changed the lives of so many other people. But it was in 1962 that I got my first glimpse of the fact that we had actually brought Fidel Castro to power. Now, since then, of course, I've had an opportunity to talk to the American ambassador to Cuba at the time when we brought Fidel Castro to power, and we actually will be having a talk, and you'll have an opportunity to see my interview with Ambassador Earl Smith, multi-billionaire. We took a film crew down to Palm Beach, Florida in 1980, I guess it was, and we actually have the interview with him, and this will be available hopefully very, very soon. And you'll actually hear Ambassador Smith explain how we brought Fidel Castro to power. Well, you can trace the American aid for communism all the way back to the time of the Russian Revolution. And as I was saying during the break, why If you study what happened immediately before and during and after the Revolution, you'll find, first of all, before the Revolution, there was Lord Milner, who headed the Cecil Rhodes Secret Society, and he was, at least according to many of the people who were in Moscow at the time, or St. Petersburg, he was actually financing the revolutionaries that brought about the March Revolution. And then, of course, after the October Revolution, when Lenin came to power, Bruce Lockhart, who was an agent of Lloyd Milner's, is sent to St. Petersburg to report back to Lenin what's going on, so that Lord Milner can keep tabs on the new revolution that's going on. And of course, there are two Americans there. Two people. One is a representative from the Federal Reserve System, a representative, I think his name was Robbins, and then of course Bruce Lockhart. And Bruce Lockhart writes this whole incredible story his book, British Agent. And he tells how Lenin would not make any move without checking with them. And Lockhart didn't understand why this was going on. In fact, at one point, the American had been insulted by one of the Russians, and he demanded of Lenin that this man, who was a faithful party member, a faithful member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party, be sent elsewhere, be demoted, and Lenin gave in to his demands. Now, why would that have happened? And of course, if you follow along with Professor Sutton's books, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, you'll find how American corporations, Exxon, our banking system, the American banks were helping the Russian central bank. Avril Harriman was over there developing, I think it was the aluminum industry, and Armin Hammer was over there helping. And there were so many, the Standard Oil Company was exploiting the oil. And we were over there doing everything we could to build up the Soviet Union. Henry Ford was over there a few years later building the Ford Motor Plant at Gorky. And through the years, why Ford has continued to update their equipment. And so many of the trucks that were actually carrying supplies down the Ho Chi Minh Trail during the Vietnam War actually came from the Ford Motor Plant built in Gorky, of course, during the Vietnam War, while the United States not only funded but built the largest truck manufacturing plant anywhere in the world, the Kama River truck manufacturing plant in Russia. And, of course, at that time, we gave the money for Fiat to build a motor plant there so we could put the wheels onto so many of the Russians who couldn't get cars before then. We did everything. We lent massive amounts of money to the Soviet Union. We'd been transferring the technology for their aircraft and their anti-aircraft batteries. And then, why, you'd never guess what happened. The Russians transferred that technology to the North Vietnamese, and they used it to kill our boys. And the Russians got about $40 billion in loans during that period of time. Why would we be funding Russia when Russia was funding North Vietnam? And the answer is really very simple. If you understand that the war was never fought to defeat communism, we're not trying to defeat communism today. Of course, we're told there is no communism in the world. There's just China, which is a communist country. We're doing everything we can to build up their economy. All of the so-called ex-communist countries are headed by former members of the Communist Party. Do you really think that communism has fallen, or are we being lied to? You know, it's been said it doesn't matter how something ridiculous is. If you say it often enough, people will believe. That today on the floor of the Senate, Senator Imhoff got up and talked about how we'd been transferring nuclear technology to communist China, missile technology to communist China. Of course, China then transfers it to Korea, and then Korea transfers it to the Islamic countries. Who do you think is funding Al-Qaeda? Communist China is funding Al-Qaeda. And who's funding communist China? Why, the United States. We're subsidizing our companies that move over there. Just this last 2 weeks, we actually guaranteed a $5 billion loan that the Export-Import Bank is going to give to communist China to build nuclear power plants. We can't build nuclear power plants in America, but they can build them over there in communist China with loans that are guaranteed by the American government. And nothing is, it appears to be, ladies and gentlemen, until you understand that everything is illusion and delusion. Why, everything will be confusing. Let's go to John, who's calling from Spokane, Washington, and our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And I assume our guest is not going to be here. So you out there in the listening audience are our guest. If you're listening on shortwave, you don't need to know what the frequency is. But our frequency on the evening program, and we have two shortwave frequencies. One is 5835. The other is 7465. So we have the two evening shortwave frequency, 5835 and 7465, and then the afternoon frequency, which is 3 to 5 Pacific or 6 to 8 Eastern, is 15120. That's 15120 megahertz. So, John, how are you doing tonight?
Dr. Spann, thank you for taking my call.
Just speak up a little louder. Go ahead.
Okay. I apologize in advance for the audio quality. I'm at a payphone. I must be one of the last people on the planet without a cell phone.
But don't feel bad.
Oh, I don't at all. I have the joy of the Lord. But I wanted your comment on how the news in recent events are pointing to the startling parallels between the United States of America and the Roman Empire. As you know, the Roman Empire was in every country of the known world. They had garrisons. And it's fascinating because I recall there was a policy under which Roman patricians, and there's some fancy Latin word for it, I don't know, but if any member of this family displeased him, he could have them summarily slaughtered, including his adult male children, which must have had for some interesting political fights. But I think of Terry Schiavo, poor Terry Schiavo, and how it's essentially a state-sanctioned murder, and the Constitution really wasn't followed in either the Florida Constitution or our Constitution. I just wanted your comment on that.
Well, I think that the analogy is a very, very valid one. What most Americans don't understand is that we've had an empire for 50 years. Ever since the Second World War, we have continued to occupy Japan and Europe and South Korea. Today, we have American troops stationed in somewhere between 120 and 140 nations throughout the world. We have FBI officers in countries throughout the world. Why do we have troops and FBI agents stationed throughout the world? Why? Because we are controlling the world. And, of course, this is a long-range plan going back almost 400 years to when the Rosicrucians came to America, and their goal was to use the power of this country to bring about the lost Atlantis, or reconstitute lost Atlantis. We were to be the new Atlantis, and we were to lead the world into the new world order, the new world religion. Now, there have been many secret societies since 1620, 1630, when the Rosicrucians came here, but all of the secret societies, whether they be the Masons or the Theosophists, or certainly the Council on Foreign Relations, because the inner core of this comes out of a secret society in England back in 1891, but all of them have one common goal, a new world order. And, of course, with this comes this total lack of concern for human life, because going along with the drive for this world empire and the new world order is the destruction of Christianity here in America. They set out 50 or 60 years ago to destroy the Christian foundation of this nation. They've done a pretty good job of it. And the thing is that, today in America, if you were to starve a cat to death, why, you'd be liable for a prison term. But it's all right to starve a woman to death as long as her husband says, "I want her starved to death." Now, she was not in a permanent vegetative state, number one. She did have brain function. I've seen pictures, at least in Time magazine, of a CT of her head. And, of course, she's massively expanded ventricles filled with fluid. That should have been drained a long time ago. Why wasn't it drained off there? Certainly, she might have had the capacity to improve if they drained that fluid and given her hyperbaric oxygen. And her husband did everything he could to block any treatment at all for this woman he says he loves. But if he really loved her, why did he marry some other? Why did he shack up with another woman and live in sin and of course, conceive two children with another woman? Anybody who believes he was dedicated to Terry Schiavo or Schiavo while he's living with another woman and having children with her, I think they got to be something wrong with their thought process. He wanted to get rid of his wife. He wanted her dead. And that's what it was really all about. The fact that the judicial system went right along with him, the fact that the Republican president and the Republican governor of Florida postured and said, "Oh, we're trying to do everything we can," Both of them had the ability, the capacity to stop this. When Bill Clinton wanted to send Elian Gonzalez back to Fidel Castro to build up Fidel Castro's stature, he didn't worry about the Constitution. He didn't worry about the courts. He just sent down 150 men and a SWAT team to seize this one little boy and whisk him off to a living hell in the workers' paradise of Cuba. When John Kennedy wanted one man to be allowed to enter into a university in the South, I think it was in old Mississippi, he sent a division of troops in there. I mean, I think it's a lot more important to save one human life than, of course, to give one man into prison, into a university. So it was obvious they had the ability to do that, and all you need to do is read the 14th Amendment to realize that no person can be deprived of life or liberty or property without due process of law. Well, she sure didn't have due process of law. She never had a jury trial. You had a couple of judges who had a political agenda, and John, this is really all about getting us to be willing to accept euthanasia here in America. That's what it's really all about. And we've started down the slippery slope, and of course, what's really so concerning to me is that there weren't, 20,000 Christians down there in front of the state legislature demonstrating. There were a few people there, but never very many. And they certainly didn't, they had no influence at all, because we're being told we're a nation of laws. No, we're a nation that's turned our back on law. The law comes not from what a judge says. The law comes from God.
Amen. Your points are well taken. Dr. Stan, a couple of quick points. I can recall in the early days of MRI machines in the 1980s, a shocking discovery was made, and that is that a lot of people, which are totally functional as you and I, totally asymptomatic, have a lot of voiding in the cerebral matter, and they may have only 60%, 40% of normal cerebral material. So her prospects for recovery were great, A. Dr. Bill Bennett expressed, I don't know if it's feigned or not, a great shock over this event. And you said before that you stopped short of saying of condemning President Bush, because you cannot know what's in a man's heart, and I cannot know what's in Bill Bennett's heart. But I would just say in an open way, Dr. Bennett, you cannot have it both ways. If you're going to go along with and empower people, such as Project for a New American Century, of which you are a member, you can't be like the Roman Empire overseas and expect us to have a respect for life at home also.
That's absolutely right.
That's about the end of my statement.
All right. Anything else you want to say?
I think that's about it. Thank you, Dr. Stan.
All right, fine. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you'd like to give us a call. And, of course, William Bennett is a... Well, William Bennett says all the right things, and then he goes out and gambles away $8 million. But I suppose when you got all the money, when you're a member of the ruling elite who really runs this country, why you don't worry so much about money. What is the project of the New American Century John was referring to? Well, you can go to their website, www.newamericancentury.org. That's newamericancentury.org. And, of course, if you go to the 1997 letters, basically they in 1997, I think it was June of 1997, they listed the people who were the founding members of the Project for the New American Century, and that included Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, John Bolton, who was just appointed the ambassador, I believe, to the United Nations, and then, of course, Liddy, who was the chief of staff for Cheney, and then Gary Bauer, and Frank Gaffney, and William Bennett. And then, of course, there's some other people, Norman Potterotz and his wife, and, of course, a number of Irving Kristol wasn't in that, but all the others were. You can get the list there at the newamericancentury.org. And these people basically said, in effect, we are going to establish an American empire. And certainly they wrote something called Rebuilding America's Defenses, and you'll find that on their website. And it was written, I think, September of 2000, a year before the 9/11 attack, when, of course, they talked about how we will not be able to pursue our goal unless there is a catastrophic and catalyzing event like another Pearl Harbor. And a few, 1 year later, we had it. Well, this is our Dan back here, and of course we were really talking this evening about Vietnam. And you really can't understand Vietnam unless you understand we were not there fighting communism. This is, of course, what they would like us to believe. Oh, the domino theory, you know, and Vietnam would go, and then Cambodia and Laos and Thailand and New Guinea and Australia and then New Zealand and the Philippines and then San Francisco. And well, that was what you had to do. You had to give the people the idea that we were really threatened. There was no threat from Vietnam. The thing is, this war was planned long ahead of time. If you hear our interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, it's in our four tape set on the Kennedy assassination, JFK assassination. But when we interviewed Fletcher Prouty, he had been the liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA. He pointed out how immediately after the Second World War, we had a great deal of military supplies in Okinawa and the other Pacific Islands. We sent it, half of it off to Korea in preparation for the Korean War. We sent the other half to Ho Chi Minh in preparation for the coming war that we were going to be having with the Vietnamese. It was all planned ahead of time. Certainly, our people worked very closely with Ho Chi Minh to help him as far as his war with the French. And then, of course, we went to war with him as well. And what people find it so difficult to believe is that there are people in our government that would create wars as diversions for what's happening here at home, and of course to increase their control over our lives. If you want to understand what Vietnam was really about, you need to get a book, the Foreign Affairs magazine for January of 1967. That's January 1967. The article is written by a man named McGeorge Bundy. And McGeorge Bundy, he was a member of Skull and Bones, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, but he is also was the national security advisor to President Kennedy and certainly President Johnson. He was the man who was instrumental in getting us into Vietnam. And in the lead article, January of 1961, he writes an article entitled The End of Either Or. And in that article, he says, you know, there are a lot of people that say that we can't even guns or butter. We can have either persistence in Vietnam or this welfare program, this program, the Great Society that Lyndon Johnson was advocating. And I'll sort of paraphrase what he says. He says it would be an act of folly for any true liberal to say we must choose between guns and butter, between persistence in Vietnam and a strong budgetary support for our domestic programs, for exactly the opposite is the case. Anyone who believes in the great new departures in health and in education and welfare, in the cause of true equality and rebuilding our cities, shouldn't say we ought to get out of Vietnam, because exactly the opposite is the case. The road forward at home is by persistence in Vietnam. And if we were to pull out of Vietnam, there'd be a strong reaction against our domestic programs. The road forward at home is by persistence in Vietnam. And if we were to pull out of Vietnam, there'd be a strong reaction against our domestic programs. Now, that was January of 1967. The war went for another 7 years. And millions of Vietnamese died during that time, totally unnecessarily. But, you see, it was a wonderful diversion. And, of course, as we watched the flag-draped coffins coming home and the weeping widows and the weeping wives, why, we were not watching what was happening here in America as they changed America forever. We've got Jim calling from Missouri. Hi, Jim. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, Doctor?
I'm doing fine, thank you. Are you listening on shortwave or internet?
Internet.
Okay, very good. Go ahead. I hope we didn't lose our whole shortwave audience. We actually changed our frequencies because of the summer session, so we'll probably get it built back up again in about 6 months, and then they'll change the frequencies again for the fall. But go ahead.
Does that happen each time the time changes?
Well, it does basically in the spring and in the fall why we change, because apparently it makes a lot of difference as far as shortwave transmission, and I think they're trying to give us the best transmission, but it sure causes a lot of confusion.
Does the sound come through pretty good on shortwave?
Oh, yeah, it can be very, very good, depending on where you are. But the key to shortwave is having a good aerial. A good what? A good aerial, good antenna.
I see.
And you can buy one down at, certainly at Radio Shack. It'll do a good job for you.
The reason I called, I heard something. Do I need to wait?
No, go ahead.
Okay, I heard something interesting lately. You know, William Crystal is the one who's in, I think he's the chairman of PNAC.
No, it's his son, William Crystal.
That is right.
But Irving Crystal is certainly one of the major people working behind the scenes, directing everything.
Well, you know, Rupert Murdoch.
Right.
Has such an influence over our lives, whether we know it or not.
All right, tell you what, we'll get to you in just a moment. We're going to have to take this break. But you're absolutely right. And, of course, William Crystal runs the Weekly Standard. And you know who finances it? A man named Rupert Murdoch. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Jim, calling from Missouri, and he's wanted to talk to us a little bit about Irving Crystal, perhaps William Crystal, too, and, of course, Rupert Murdoch. Irving Crystal certainly has been around for a long period of time. At one time, he was the editor of either the New Republic or Nation magazine. I can't remember which, but he wrote a book afterwards saying, I was the editor of that magazine for years. I never knew it was a CIA front organization. And all I can say is, Mr. Crystal, if you are the editor of a magazine and you don't know it's a CIA front, why, you're in real trouble. Go ahead.
Well, it was my call was actually more about Rupert Murdoch.
Okay, fine.
You know he owns Fox News.
Right.
FX. Of course, he's got Bill O'Reilly talking about the decadence in our culture, and his network FX is as close to the pay cable as you can get, you know, as far as cable channels. Fox Broadcast Channel, the New Republic, like you said, the Weekly Standard, like you said, used to own the Los Angeles Dodgers, but he also owns HarperCollins Publishing House. And do you have any idea what they recently bought?
No, I tell you that. What have you read the book, The New Media Monopoly by Ben Bagdakian? Because he points out there are five major corporations that own or dominate almost all the media, and of course, Rupert Murdoch is one of those.
Well, HarperCollins, owned by Rupert Murdoch, recently bought the Zondervan Publishing Company.
Oh, they did that a long time ago.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's better. He's controlled the major Christian publications for a long period of time.
And did you know that Zondervan now actually opens on Sunday?
Well, I wouldn't be at all surprised. I mean, certainly what has happened is, you know, we have the whole Christian movement, the conservative movement, the anti-communist movement, they've all been usurped and taken over, and the average American has no idea what's going on. And we wonder why we work hard, and we always seem to lose. We work hard for the Republicans, and we work hard for the Democrats. Doesn't seem to really matter who's in power, why the same policies continue. And of course, that reason we never understand what's going on is because five mega corporations dominate the media, and certainly one of those is Fox, pretends to be conservative. Well, he's about as conservative as Gorbachev.
Well, at least we get to throw the rascals out every 4 years.
Right, and we always feel better when we do that, but nothing changes. And, of course, the question is why? Well, of course, that's the subject of our March newsletter. It's already written, and hopefully it'll be available very soon. I hope you get a copy, because it points out it's all a scam. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Jim, calling from Missouri, and he wanted to point out that Rupert Murdoch, who, of course, is everybody tries to tell us he's conservative, but if you look at the things he publishes, so much of what he publishes and so much of his cable, you know, is just totally depraved, and he has Bill O'Reilly up there pretending to be a conservative, but Bill O'Reilly's on the wrong side on so many issues. But what people don't understand is that five mega corporations dominate the American media, and it's all listed in a book called The New Media Monopoly by Professor Ben Bagdakian. This is the seventh edition of his book. When he did the first edition back in 83, there were 50 mega corporations that dominated the media, and of course, here we are almost 22 years later, and that's down to 5. And they have a stranglehold on what most people read. And, of course, Jim was concerned because Zondervan is owned by Murdoch. Now, Murdoch has owned Zondervan for a long period of time, one of the major Christian ministries. And we wonder why the major Christian ministries are not publishing books that really tell us what's going on in the world today. I share your concern about Mr. Rupert and about Mr. Crystal and the agenda of these people who have an entirely different worldview than you and I do, and nobody would ever accuse these people of being Christians.
The last time I was in the Family Christian store, I saw also that they've just rolled out probably at least half a dozen editions of that Today's New International Bible.
Right.
That's the...
Is that the one, the he and she and
yes,
all that? And you have to understand, what they're trying to do is destroy the traditions. They want to destroy the traditions of the Protestant church. They want to destroy the traditions of the Catholic church. And then you have nothing to cling to at all. And they know exactly what they're doing. And people end up without anything to believe in. They don't know what to believe in anymore. And after all, Zondervan, everybody knows they're a Christian publishing house. They're not a Christian publishing house. They were purchased by the enemy. And I consider Rupert Murdoch the enemy of freedom. I consider him the enemy of Christianity. And little wonder we're in the trouble we are today.
Do you realize that he is the publisher of the largest selling nonfiction book of all time?
And what is that?
The Purpose-Driven Life.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Right.
I've heard your guests on those previous shows talk about that book.
Oh, well, tell you what, this movement is sweeping the Christian church. And, you know, if you are in one of those churches and you object to what's happening, they throw you out of the church. Real Christian love.
Well, that's all I had, Dr. Stan. I just wanted to say hello. And sometimes I enjoy your open phone programs as well as any of your guests.
Thanks so much.
Yes,
good
sir.
To talk to you, Jim.
Bye-bye.
And let's go to Jeannie. Again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And our regularly scheduled guest didn't show up, so Jeannie shows up. How are you doing, Jeannie?
Well, I'm just dandy. I hope you have your thinking cap on.
All right.
I'm going to ask you a question.
Well, I don't know now if it's a tough question.
No.
I might go into may have a paroxysm of coughing or something.
Let's see. Jane Fonda, she was quoted as such, and I'm trying to find the quote. I'm sure I find it on the Internet. But she said, quote, "You should be thankful and get on your knees for having communism coming." And do you remember that quote?
Yes, I do. But I don't know whether she really is believes that anymore. It would be very interesting. I'm going to try to get her onto our program. You know, she's written a new book, and she has sort of apologized for some of the things she said in the past, but she wouldn't apologize for going to North Vietnam and, of course, for giving, radio broadcasts to our troops, which, of course, was a treasonous act. Now, I disagree with the war, but I certainly don't want the communists to win, and that's what was wrong with what she did. She wanted the communists to win. She wanted us to lose. That's all the difference. Now, maybe she's changed. After all, my views on Vietnam have changed through the years, but you're absolutely right. She said you ought to get down on your knees and pray that one day we will be a communist nation.
And then what she did with the POWs, where they came out to actually shake hands with her. And as she was going down the line, there was one man that had a slip of paper with the names of the POWs there so she could bring it back to the States. And she gave that slip of paper to the head guy at the Viet Cong, and they tortured and they killed some of those guys.
Well, I think that she is responsible for that. And, of course, she should have been tried for treason at the time.
That's right.
But, of course, she wasn't. You have to understand, Jeannie, it wasn't a war. Our leaders were doing everything they could to finance communism, to help the communists. I mean, there were areas, the Mekong River, you know, where they were taking up supplies to the communists. We weren't allowed to stop that. We weren't allowed to stop the ships coming into the harbor at Haiphong carrying the weapons. we weren't allowed to mine the harbor there until we were committed to pulling out. It was all a sham from the very beginning. We weren't allowed to bomb the major targets at all. We would send, and I know one of my friends was actually flying F-4s at the time, I mean, they'd send three planes up, each with a third of the load of bombs. Why would they do that? Because they weren't trying to win. It was all a scam. And until the American people understand that we financed the North Vietnamese during the war, and you need to get Professor Sutton's book, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy, and we actually have my interview with Professor Sutton by the same name, and then get the details and think about what really happened. How could the greatest nation in the world, you know, the strongest nation in the world, spend 10 years fighting a country the size of the state of Mississippi and lose the war unintentionally?
What kind of book did she write now?
Well, it's a story of her life, and it's sort of a tragic.
Who needs it?
What?
Who needs it?
Well, I think that it would be great to interview her. I would
really
love to ask her some very leading questions. Because, you know, I think she was right in opposing the war. She just opposed it for all the wrong reasons, and she wanted the communists to win, and that is inexcusable.
Well, for our POWs to be tortured and killed, I don't see how she never brought that up in her interview, or probably not in the book either.
Well, Chris, maybe she doesn't know, or maybe she doesn't want to know, or maybe she feels badly about it. I would like to think that maybe she's changed and grown up a lot. But
well, Dr. Stan, I know a lot of communists, and not many actually go away from that philosophy.
Well, I know that Bella Dodd did, and in fact, I've met a fair number of people who have left communism. Whitaker Chambers, certainly one of my favorite writers, was a lifelong communist, and of course, he changed from there. The communists, basically, a lot of them are very idealistic people. They just don't understand that they're being manipulated just as you and I are being manipulated.
Well, it's ironic or a coincidence that she should apologize when her book is coming out. But Dr. Stan, I'll never buy anything that she's going to get money from, whether it's videos of exercise or books. I just don't need that type of person.
Well, I'm not going to buy her book. I'm going to get a review copy of it.
Okay,
anything else, Jenny?
No, but I'm not pleased with her at all. And all right, I know the guys in the service that were tortured under her.
I will ask her about that. Could you give me any documentation on that? Because I'm going to try to get her on my program.
Oh, good.
Okay, would you see if you can come up with that quotation you mentioned about the, you know, we'd be lucky if we have communism here.
Yeah, fall on your knees and be thankful.
Right. Get up on the internet, see if you can track that down, especially about the boys being tortured.
Yeah, okay.
God bless.
Yeah, bye.
Bye-bye. Well, let's go to Ricardo calling from Chicago. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Hi, Ricardo. How are you doing?
Fine, Dr. Stan. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing just fine, thanks.
That's great, great. Listen, I was calling the ref because I heard you guys mention about the purpose-driven life.
Right.
How true is that book? I mean, how the articles, the paragraphs, the statements that's related to, what is that book really related to?
Well, the thing is that this is this whole idea that we are going to remake the church here. And really, it's the purpose. There's two books, Purpose-Driven, the Church and the Purpose-Driven Life. And the Purpose-Driven Life is the one that I think that, sold 10 million copies or so. And what they do is they come up, and they've got all these translations of the Bible. There are 15 different translations of the Bible. Why would you use 15 different translations of the Bible unless you were going to try to confuse people? And, of course, the one that they use is one by a fellow named Peterson, which, of course, is not a translation of the Bible. I don't really know what it is, but what it does is totally destroy, the whole context of the Bible. And what they are doing is changing the message of the church, and they're changing the music of the church. And I've heard certainly Rick Warren say, there is no such thing as Christian music. There are only Christian lyrics. And so don't criticize us, for our music. Well, their music is played old rock music. It comes right out of the pit of hell, and it has a profound impact on people's minds and upon their souls. Why are you bringing the devil's music into the Christian church? This movement is sweeping the church. There have been over 360,000 laymen and ministers have been indoctrinated in this, and it is a method of management. It has nothing to do with Christianity. It has to do with management and control.
Okay, so what we just say is all a fabrication then. Well, I mean, it's a bunch of lies.
Right.
Okay, now I have another question, not clearly related to what you guys are talking about tonight. I'm a reader of Dan Brown. You know who that guy is, right?
Oh, sure, yeah. They mean Angels and Demons and the Divinity.
Yes, I read that entire book, Angels and Demons, and I was just recently watching the program on television about the Pope. And a lot of statements that's inside of that book that I was reading, it reflects to what they're going to have to go through now in order to choose a new pope.
But
is that how that really works?
It's really how it really works, but do not believe anything that Dan Brown writes.
Oh,
certainly,
okay.
He talks about the Illuminati, and the Illuminati
right.
was a very, very real force, and I'm glad he at least called people's attention to this. But his books, both Angels and Demons, and, of course, the Da Vinci Code, they're both based upon false premises. They're both represent his anti-Christian bigotry, and even though I'm not a Catholic, I think what he is trying to do, he's trying to destroy the Catholic Church, and then of course he'll come after the Protestants next. He has an agenda. The reason this book has been pushed as hard as it has, it's a good book, interesting reading, but its real purpose is to confuse people about Christianity. And if you've read the Da Vinci Codes, his whole thesis that Jesus had an affair with Mary Magdalene, nobody thought he was God until the 4th century, that's a blasphemous lie.
And that Jesus Christ's children are descendants of today's people now.
Right.
And, I was going to buy the book and read it. But, after Angels and Demons, I've been kind of doing a little bit studying on him over the Internet, it's been a lot of disturbing things, a lot of questions that I needed to be asked about him. You know what I'm saying? Because it was just kind of a little bit with all of his secret notes and all of his hidden clues and all of this kind of stuff. It makes you believe that he's like a deceiver, you know?
He is a master deceiver. He's a great writer. It's a great story. But I don't think people ought to read it unless they really understand the history of the church. The significance of the Council of Nicaea, who Constantine was, who St. Augustine was, who Arius was.
Mm-hmm.
And the difficulty is most people are not that solidly grounded in church history, and they're taken in. Let me tell you that if you read the Gospels, Jesus said he was God. I am the way and the truth and the life, and no man cometh unto the Father but through
me.
And
right.
if you study the Gospels, you realize that Dan Brown has an agenda,
mm-hmm.
and that's to destroy Christianity. So we certainly do not suggest that people read his books at all.
Okay.
All
right, then. And thanks a lot, Dr.
God bless you, Ricardo.
Right,
thanks so
you
much.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Angela calling from New York. Hi, Angela.
Oh, hi, Dr. Stan. I wanted to ask you, I understood that Jane Fonda has become a born-again Christian.
That's my understanding, and although she is still a pro-abortion, but I understand she has become a born-again Christian, and... at least this is what has been widely circulated.
Uh-huh. Oh, but she's still for abortion?
Right. Well, but I'm going to get her on the program, so I hope I have a chance
that.
To talk to her about it.
I would love that so much. And also what I wanted to ask you, that's why I watched 60 Minutes, but they cut it down to edit it down to 8 minutes, and we didn't get the whole story. And also I wanted to ask you, this book on purpose-driven life?
Yeah, but a purpose-driven church, a purpose-driven life. Like, go ahead. Yeah.
Is this a book good for Christianity?
No.
No? Okay, I've got to write that down in my notes. What is it about? That girl was on television.
I don't know which girl you're speaking of.
That he took as a hostage. she was reading it, I believe Asher.
Oh, yes, right. You're talking about the gentleman who, of course, had killed a couple of people, and then he escaped to this woman's apartment, and she was reading to him for the purpose of having life. Well, this whole thing is an effort, of course, to make people think that this has a great deal of power, and it does have a great deal of power. The power to destroy the Christian message. And they're doing a good job with it.
I was not aware of it.
We have a four-tape set on the church growth movement. We have an excellent video with our good friend Dr. Bob Klink, who will be a guest here next week, on the purpose-driven life, the purpose-driven church. We have certainly several books, Deceived on Purpose, and let's see, Who's Driving the Purpose-Driven Church? So we have two books, and we have a DVD. We have either video or DVD, and then, of course, we have our four-tape set. This whole thing is to change the message and the music of the church. And it is a management technique of how the minister now can control the parishioners, and anybody who doesn't go with his agenda is thrown out of the church. That doesn't sound very loving to me, does it?
No.
The ideas come from a man named Peter Drucker, who is a, in my opinion, is a transformational Marxist, and it all has to do with management techniques. How you control people. They use these techniques in corporations. They use them in government, and now they're moving them into the church. And it's going to work. It's going to change the church, but not forever. I think we're seeing the great apostasy that's really described in the scriptures. Angela, and I'm very concerned. And I hope you'll get all those people up there New York, upstate New York, listening to our program. Will you work
out? I enjoy it so much, and I thank you so much. I certainly won't purchase that book now. Thank you.
Please don't. Bye-bye. God bless you.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bless you also.
All right. Well, we've got Eric calling from Oklahoma. Eric, how are you doing?
Dr. Stanley Monty, it's very nice to talk to you.
Good to have you with us.
Are we up against a break?
Okay. Well, we're up against a break, so if you have a question, and then we'll go to the break, and then we'll answer it.
I wanted more of a dialogue. But.
All right, fine. We'll be right back in just a moment here then, and we'll have 3 minutes to dialogue, and then we'll have to let you go.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Dr. Stan, we've got Eric calling from Oklahoma. Okay, Eric, go ahead.
Dr. Stan, it's just great to talk to you. You're on when I get off work, and I listen to you before I go to bed, so you're a friend to me. And yeah, I heard that Jane Fonda had gone to one of the large black churches in Atlanta and been converted to Christianity. And if you've ever been to a black service, you would see how that could be a powerful thing, and I have no doubt that she has honestly had a conversion experience. You know as well as I that the church growth movement is very interesting, to say the least, but you can't fault people for trying to find the truth.
No, not at all. But of course, I really believe that this is almost so like an Amway conference. And you talk to the people who've been to these big conferences, and they come away, well, just like the people who've been to an Amway conference, tremendous psychological impact on the people. And boy, we're going to get the biggest church in town. We're going to make a lot of money. But what about the Christian message? Well, we're going to modify it so that we can bring people in once we get them into the church. Then, we can, in the classes, why we can begin to bring them into a relationship with the Lord. But the important thing is to bring people in, to make it grow.
I really never, my eyes were not opened until I started reading books from the 50s about dialectical materialism in the communist movement, it was the how communists were infiltrating the churches in the 50s. Very, very interesting. It's a very interesting subject.
And now, of course, many of them are cardinals and members of the a senior pastorate in many of the Protestant churches.
They teach at the seminaries.
We're out. Yeah, that's right. We're out of time, Eric. God bless. Thanks so much for calling.
God bless you. I enjoy you so much.
Well, oh, wait a minute. We got one more minute, so we'll let you go for another minute. But anyway, it's good to know people are out there listening. You know, sometimes I sit here in this empty studio all by myself. My only contact with the humanity is a television screen that tells me who's calling in. So it's always good to hear from you.
You know, I live out in the woods, and I just try to edify myself with information and good thoughts. And then you are certainly one of my you're my hero.
Well, God bless you. Thanks very much for calling, Eric.
God bless you, Dr. Stan.
Right, bye-bye.
Good night.
Okay, fine. We got Jim here. Jim, a quick question?
Just a comment, Stan. In regard to the Da Vinci Code, I didn't know if you knew this, but there's a couple of sources out there that are saying that Jesus' bloodline goes back to the Nephilim. Have you heard that?
No, I haven't, but I've heard it goes back to Mary Magdalene and is the basis of the Merovingian bloodline.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, go ahead, Jim.
Well, you know, the Merovingian, they have a shield, which is kind of an inverted cross, which is it's a Latin cross that's simultaneously right side up and upside down. And I've seen an exposition on that. And they think that that's a symbol of Jesus' bloodline that goes back through David and then goes all the way back to the Nephilim.
Well,
they don't base that on what it says in Genesis chapter 6, though. They base it on an interpretation from one of the apocalyptic writings. Well, I think it's one of the writings of Enoch.
Well, I'll tell you what, of course, there's always this effort to destroy Christianity, and this is just another example of it. And there's no scientific basis for it at all.
No, I agree with you. What's in the Da Vinci Code is fiction. There's no evidence that Jesus had any children. You can't find any solid record of it in any patristic writing or in Eusebius.
In fact, there's a book out there. It's called Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And actually, I saw an interview with a man who wrote it, and they were saying, well, now, certainly, this is a fascinating thing that you've come up with, and this great revelation. And the author said, I'm not saying I believe anything in this book that I wrote. So I think that's probably the best way to look at it. Even the author didn't believe it. Hey, I got to run because we're out of time, Jim. God bless. And thanks so much for calling. Let's, Jeannie, quick, you got that? We're out of time, but
yes,
go ahead.
Quote, November 21, 1970, Jane Fonda told the University of Michigan audience, which was 2,000 students, if you understood what communism was, you would hope, you would pray on your knees that we would someday become communists. And again she says, I, a socialist, think that we should strive towards a socialist society all the way to communism.
Well, I think she doesn't understand, but a lot of people have been very confused. At one time, I was a socialist too, Jeannie, so I could come around. Let's hope Jean Fonda has. Well, it's going to be very interesting. Let's just hope and pray we can get her on as a guest, okay?
All right, bye.
Thank you, and you hang on to that. I want a copy of that, Jeannie.
Okay.
God bless. All right, well, this is Dr. Stan here, and of course, I hope you've enjoyed the program. It's always a little nerve-wracking when our guest doesn't show up, but anyway, we'll get Ken on again because he's got a wonderful, wonderful message. That's Ken Klein, and he has a wonderful message about the scriptures and about prophecies, and I think you'll be fascinated by it, but that'll give you something to look forward to in the future. This is the time when we certainly want to mention that if you have not yet seen the video, They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. You need to see it. And my wife was telling me a little bit about, I think it's the third tape. Remember that there's a 10-hour version. The third tape in the 10-hour version has a section on Michael Jackson in it. And, well, you might, if you really want to understand what energizes Michael and why he has such a predilection for little boys, you probably would want to get this 10-hour version of They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. Now, the 4-hour version has a great deal on Michael Jackson in it. But this will give you a real understanding into the spiritual battle we're fighting today, because it's not simply the people in the music industry who've sold their souls to the devil and who worship the devil. Why, people at the highest levels of our government do as well. And you really need to get into the background of the Skull and Bones, the Bohemian Grove, and of course, even the spiritual forces behind the Council on Foreign Relations. If you haven't yet read my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. That's The Brotherhood of Darkness, the book, the video, the audio tape, or get them all together as The Brotherhood of Darkness special. And then, of course, we hope many of you will want to get my interviews with Professor Sutton, going into the background of how we financed the North Vietnamese during the war, And, of course, his book, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy, actually it contains Professor Sutton's testimony before the Republican National Committee in 1972, where, of course, he talked about America's subsidies for the North Vietnamese. And 1972, the war was still going when Professor Sutton got back to the conservative Hoover Institute in Pasadena. You never guess. His name was gone off the door. His telephone was disconnected. And, of course, they got rid of him just as fast as they could, because the last thing they want is for the American people to understand Vietnam and all of the wars are scams. As they say, the only place, of course, where you count your profits in dollars and your losses in lives. Pray for America. Pray for its liberty. Pray for our provision and protection. We'll be right back for the next hour. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us a young man who's going to be, I hope, a regular guest here. It's Joel Skousen's son, Andrew Skousen, and he is one of the researchers for World Affairs Brief. And so we're going to be going over the World Affairs Brief from last Friday. Now, if you don't take World Affairs Brief, you're really missing something I think is very important. You can find it on the Internet. And I go there every morning after I've done checked a few things on the net and then checked my emails. And I go to World Affairs Brief, and they've simply summarized all of the major news for the previous 24 or 48 hours. It's all there, and you can read the summaries. If you're interested, why, you pull it down. If not, at least you have an idea of what people are talking about. And so they go to newswithviews.com or Newsmax or WorldNet Daily or the Asia Times or the India Times or all these websites where it is not controlled. You must understand that the media in the United States is controlled. You're not getting the truth. But here's an opportunity to get a worldview encapsulated. You can go through it in 15 minutes, unless, of course, you pull down too many of the articles, as I'm prone to do. But, Andrew, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Certainly. My pleasure, Dr. Stan.
Okay, well, let's get started. Where are we going to get started first thing?
Well, we have a very interesting brief this week. We've got a topic about some interesting developments in the Abu Ghraib scandal, some very interesting article about the Halliburton and the Iraqi bidding companies and some of the some misspent dollars there, as well as a little bit about Terry Schiavo's death and a little bit about doctor-assisted suicides and euthanasia.
All right, well, let's get started with Abu Ghraib. What's new on Abu Ghraib? I mean, this tragic story of a once great Christian nation actually tolerating, in fact, actually encouraging torture. Now, people can't say, well, we don't do this. We don't condone this. Of course we condone it. You know, they have, of course, gone ahead and convicted a couple of soldiers, but they all had a common story. We were ordered to do this. We were ordered by the contract agents. How many contract agents, which are really, of course, sheep-dipped CIA agents, how many of them have been indicted? And none of them have been. But now, apparently, the ACLU has come up with some sort of a document. Why don't you get into the background of this, Andrew?
Yeah. This story is actually sort of double-sided. It's rather a slick way of drawing attention away from the true issue at stake here. So it's, even though it sounds like it's a step in the right direction, it's actually a fancy bit of footwork.
And I think that's really what's so important. They plant articles to actually change the thrust of what it is. For instance, when they wanted to just get Vioxx back on the market, it already killed probably 50 or 75,000 Americans. Why? What they did is, of course, they had a panel, and the panel came in and said, oh, yes, there's a little danger, but we ought to put it back on the market. And the panel was packed with people who worked for the drug company. And so they put Vioxx and Betrax and Celebrex back in the market, and they're going to kill hundreds of thousands of Americans. But you do that by, of course, confusing the American people so they can't see what's happening. We'll be back in just a moment with Andrew to see how we're doing that with the Abu Ghraib story. Well, Andrew, why don't you explain to our listeners how they're doing this, how this whole scam works?
All right. Well, the ACLU came out with an interesting volley in this, it claimed to have discovered a real smoking gun in a September 14th, 2003 memo by an Army Lieutenant General by the name of Ricardo Sanchez. Now, at the time, this Lieutenant General was the senior commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, and the ACLU got this memo with under a Freedom of Information request. But this is a very interesting situation here. What happened is, in the memo, Sancho authorized prisoner interrogation tactics that were more harsh than those that are generally accepted in Army practice, including the use of guard dogs to exploit, quote, Arab fear of dogs, using sleep deprivation, stress manipulation, and hot and cold environments. The ACLU claims that this memo clearly establishes that General Sanchez authorized unlawful interrogation techniques for use in Iraq, and in particular, these techniques violate the Geneva Conventions and the Army's own field manual governing interrogation, end quote. Now, the ACLU is really sort of grasping at straws with this memo. The Pentagon did an investigation on torture in Abu Ghraib, authored by an Admiral Church, and they claim that, quote, none of the techniques contained in Sanchez's interrogation policies would have permitted abuses such as those at Abu Ghraib. Now, this is correct, but the rest of Church's report actually deliberately whitewashed this. So what's going on here is this a case of kind of a straw man argument where they put forth something that's fairly easy to knock down and discredit. And at the same time, it's sort of slick. The American people are expecting investigations to uncover exactly what happened. And what's happening is they kind of point you in the right direction by saying, okay, well, it's true there were some leaders who did issue some directives, some commands that allowed this to happen, but these weren't nearly the kinds of commands that would have allowed the terrible things to come on, sort of leading people to believe, oh, well, it was just a couple of rogue people who went out of the way. And it kind of puts the public to sleep about the issue of, well, it was the commanding officers who issued these received orders that allowed it to be so widespread.
Well, I my impression is probably a lot of this was CIA as well. We'll be right back here with Andrew Kelton. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, is Andrew Skousen, and we're talking about this memo that's been supposedly, this smoking gun that's come up from the Anti-Christian Lawyers Union. Now, first of all, it's very hard to get anything out of government today unless they want you to get it. And so they plant things all the time so that you think you're really getting the inside information, and usually you're not. You're getting exactly what they want you to believe. And this doesn't really sound sleep deprivation. Certainly, they've done this for a long time. And, you know, not too hot or too cold, things of that sort. You know, but the idea of having these people naked and using electric shock on them and beating them and actually killing some of these people, beating them to death, a lot of this was done by the CIA operatives, and they're not bringing that aspect of it out at all, are they?
That's right. That's exactly right, Dr. Stan. And the fact that the beatings were so widespread and so commonplace among it, I think, is clear and convincing evidence that there were at least verbal orders given throughout the Iraq theater. And it's interesting to note that this didn't just occur at the Abu Ghraib prison. So this is widespread throughout almost all of the prisons there. So this isn't something that just was a couple of people getting out of hand. These were people who were allowed to do this, who knew that the officers from up above were sanctioning this and actually ordering it to happen. So this is a very terrible cover up and a diversion.
Really, and I think that the last thing is that they don't want the American people to realize how immoral the people are in charge. So they say, we would never do anything like that. We would never authorize torture. But the question is, well, if you didn't authorize it, why didn't you start firing people at the very top? Because the people at the top are responsible, like the Secretary of Defense or the people in his department. And instead of that, of course, why they get promoted like Mr. Wolf. What's he going to be doing now? He was Assistant Secretary of Defense. Now he's going to be President of the World Bank. Go ahead.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Maybe that's what they call a demotion.
Precisely, Sergeant. Good point.
Well, anyway, I mean, I think that the American people have to realize that the government is never going to say, we authorize torture, because there's still an awful lot of good people out here who would be horrified to know that it's not only going on here, it's gone on for a long period of time. It went on with the dark side of government, with the CIA operatives in Vietnam. And of course, a generation later, the CIA operatives are working in Iraq. And, of course, they are not held to any accounting at all, because they are above the law.
That's exactly right. And anytime something is brought to light about these mercenaries, the government claims no responsibility because conveniently they are contracted out and separate companies from the government. So the government can feign that they had no control. It's a very sophisticated system that they use.
A system of deception is what it really is.
Yes, exactly. That's right.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, let's move on to a slightly different topic, but still about Iraq. Let's talk about the Iraqi parliament, which is has been in place for 2 months now and is still in a heated deadlock. There's a Reuters story about this that comments thusly, quote, Iraq's parliament erupted in acrimony at only its second sitting on Tuesday, and journalists were thrown out after legislators berated leaders for failing to agree on a new government 2 months after election. When parliamentarians were told that despite last-minute talks that delayed the session, no agreement had been reached, even on the post of parliamentary speaker, several stood up to say leading politicians were leading down the Iraqi people, end quote. Now, contrast this with President Bush, who continues to proclaim that as you expected, the new Iraqi government will soon be formed, and that Iraq will serve as an example of freedom in a long troubled part of the world. This is a duplicitous comment, given the fact that the president and his administration are using this language to avoid responsibility for the stalemate, which they have imposed by requiring the nearly impossible condition that all elected officials, that they have imposed on elected officials, that they have to have a two-thirds majority in order to form a government. Now, although this sounds appropriate at the outset, it's important to realize the large portion of minorities and different conflicting ethnic groups here in this country. This guarantees that all of the minority groups, especially the Kurds, can hold the majority Shiites hostage to their demands. Although it seems like the majority groups would have a better position, they actually have to acquiesce to the minority groups in order to gain an overall majority over the parliament, especially when it requires a two-thirds to get anything done.
In fact, that was very interesting that one of the men they're considering to be the new premier or president or whatever it will be of Iraq is actually a Kurd, but he's a Shia Kurd, he's a Shia Muslim Kurd, so he would then, of course, be able to identify with the people in the south. But the only way that the Kurds are going to cooperate is, of course, if they get their man in, and they only make up maybe 20% of the country. The Kurds make up 60%, but what they've done is they've created an impossible situation there, and they can't get anything accomplished, and that's exactly what we want. We don't want a stable government over there. If we did, how would we justify staying on? We are building a $560 million embassy. If we're going to go home, why are we building a $560 million embassy? Why don't we just take one of those old palaces and recondition it? And I thought it ought to be good enough. If it was good enough for Saddam Hussein, all the marble and the pillars and all those things, we ought to be able to make that good enough for an embassy. Why are we putting in a $560 million embassy? And I don't think we're going home. Do you, Andrew?
No, that's a very good point, Dr. Stan. And it's another issue that illustrates how they are gearing up to stay for a long time here.
But, of course, you can't let the American people know that. They have to think that we went into weapons of mass destruction when we couldn't find any. We went into, of course, to bring democracy, but, you know, we don't really want to bring democracy. We want to bring confusion and chaos. And do you realize that almost 2 years after the war, they still don't have electricity regularly in Baghdad or water regularly in Baghdad? And, you know, and the sewer in many of these parts of the country is just not working. How could you do such a poor job unintentionally? A country that can send a man to the moon and a probe to Mars can't get the electricity working in Baghdad? Do you honestly believe that?
That's a very good point. And that leads into the next article in the World Affairs Brief, Dr. Stan. Which is that there's been a great deal of corruption with some of the major corporations that the U.S. government hired to rebuild Iraq.
Okay, what sort of cooperation is corruption, and who are they?
Yeah, well, as you know, this is a multi-billion-dollar prospect of getting these large-scale projects from the government. I mean, if you think about the public works projects that are so hotly bid for here in the United States, and think about that on a scale of the entire country, this is billions and billions of dollars worth of work over who knows how many years to come. So this is a pretty solid prospect that many companies would have liked to have bid for.
But, of course, a lot of these were no-bid contracts, weren't they? In other words, they were given to favor certain favored companies?
Yes, that's precisely the case. Now, Newsweek had a lead article about this, and sort of suspiciously, kind of in the same vein of leading the public in a general direction, but not carrying it far enough, Newsweek's article talked about one of the Iraqi contractors. And the Newsweek article is true in most of what it says, but false in the gross omissions that it left out. And we'll cover this here. In the April 4th, 2005 issue of Newsweek, it's quoted that Custer Battles was a nightmare contractor in Iraq. The company's two principals, Mike Battles and Scott Custer, overcharged occupation authorities by millions of dollars, according to a complaint from two former employees. The firm double-billed for salaries and repainted the Iraqi Airways forklift they found at Baghdad Airport, which Custer Battles was contracted to secure, and then leased them back to the U.S. government, the complaint says. In the fall of 2004, Deputy General Counsel Stephen Shaw of the U.S. Air Force asked that the firm be banned from future U.S. contracts, saying Custer Battles had also created sham companies whereby it fraudulently increased profits by inflating its claimed costs. Now, these revelations came forth thanks to two whistleblowers within the company who sued Custer Battles on behalf of the U.S. government. But now it's very interesting what happens next. Inexplicably, the Bush administration declines to take part in the suit or support the plaintiffs. Now, this is inexplicable unless you understand that the U.S. government has collusion with certain favored corporations. Newsweek quotes the whistleblower's attorney as saying, quote, the government has not lifted a finger to get back the $50 million Custer Battles defrauded it of, unquote.
I think it was Major General Smedley Butler who had, certainly was the most famous Marine general of the first half of the last century. I think he died about 1939, but he had two congressional medals, and one of his remarks was, war is a racket. It's the only racket in the world where you measure the profits in dollars and the losses in lives. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Andrew Skousen, and of course we're going to go through the World of Bears brief, and if you don't get up on their website and get their weekly commentary, why you're missing a real opportunity to understand what's going on, the information you're not going to get from Rush Limbaugh. All right, Andrew, why don't you pick up the story there?
All right, well, what's particularly interesting about this article is that it failed to mention the most egregious account of a company defrauding the U.S. government of more than millions of dollars, and that is the case of the Halliburton Company. Now, this is a case where another powerful and high-placed whistleblower has emerged to document the inside collusion between Halliburton / KBR and the Bush administration. Most of this is documented in Vanity Fair's magazine. Michael Schneerson has done an extensive report on the testimony of a former top official at the Army Corps of Engineers, whose name is Bernatine Greenhouse.
Now, is this a new article in Vanity Fair?
Yes, this article was found in Vanity Fair.
Okay, fine.
And this person's real name is Bernatine Greenhouse, but she goes by Bunny. Now, this is a minority woman who rose to high position at the Corps of Engineers. And a lot of the reason that she rose up was minority advancement practices, a policy, and in fact a policy that many of the generals regret today, I'm sure. Bunny, it seems, turned out to be a little bit more principled than they anticipated. So here's a short summary of what happened. Vanity Fair reports that, quote, Halliburton subsidiary KBR got $12 billion worth of exclusive contracts for Iraq.
$12 billion?
$12 billion, exactly. I mean, Custer Battles that got the millions of dollars worth of contracts is nothing compared to what KBR, the Halliburton subsidiary company, got. $12 billion worth of exclusive contracts for work in Iraq. But even more shocking is how KBR spent some of the money. This person is blowing the whistle on this company, and I should mention that that Halliburton is closely linked to Dick Cheney. One of the interesting points that they point out is that Dick Cheney had been the vice president. Had been Halliburton's CEO from 1995 to 2000, and when he left the job with an estimated $35 million, he still continued to get six-figure deferred salary compensation from the company. Now, he denies these accusations, but it's the connection is still there nonetheless. So what we're trying to document here is that there are certain companies that are favored, and that these companies are taken care of by the government, are protected by the government, often participate in illegal actions and don't get prosecuted by the government. And this is a very telling case of it. Let's examine this just a little bit further. This Bunnetine Greenhouse has actually been a little bit of a nuisance since the build-up to the war in Iraq. She's been questioning contracts and writing caveats in them in sort of a spidery handwriting. And
hold that thought for just a minute. We're going to have to bring our stations back on board.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Andrew has been talking about the fact that Halliburton got $12 billion in non-bid contracts. In other words, just almost like a gift. All you have to do is what we ask you to do, but of course, they're chiseling on this, but there's a woman over there. She's a black woman who's in the procurement office, and suddenly she's saying, these people are crooked. You know? They're cheating us right and left, and of course, she's becoming a real thorn in people's sides over there. She's pointing out that there's corruption. Can you imagine that? And apparently there's a new article in Vanity Fair magazine, which we haven't seen, but we're certainly going to get and read it. So what is this woman's name? And pick up the story from there, Andrew.
Right, well, this person's name is Bunnetine, or Bunny, Greenhouse. And she was the officer in charge of, like you say, ensuring that that any work contracted out by the Army Corps of Engineers to private industries was properly, was granted in a fair and above board way. And for 2 years, this Greenhouse lady had been asking hard questions about why the head of the Corps, to whom she reported directly, kept giving exclusive, non-competitive contracts to KBR, and they had, up until that point, amounted to $10.8 billion. Greenhouse had a way of being fearless, and she was also blunt, which was surprising in the Corps' male hierarchy. And then in October 6th of 2004, this Greenhouse was summoned by the Corps' Deputy Commander, Major General Robert Griffin. And she knew that the top brass was eager to finalize the Corps' latest contract for KBR, a $75 million extension for troop support in the Balkans. And this had gone through several drafts already, and most of these drafts had been because Greenhouse kept raising questions about the rationale for giving it specifically to KBR about competitive bidding. What she didn't know was that her superiors had already made the decision against her. She entered the general's office. I'm paraphrasing from the Vanity Fair article, and he handed her a letter that explained that she was demoted for poor performance. A curious indictment, given that she had received high performance ratings before the war. The demotion would knock her down to the government rank of GS-15. Which was like going from senior vice president in a Fortune 500 company to middle management. She could instead retire with full benefits, she was, after all, 60. But Greenhouse decided to choose a third option, and that was to hire a lawyer and fight the demotion. Now, I'm trying to bring this to the part where it specifically documents how KBR got these contracts. If we skip down a little bit further in the article, it talks about this.
Well, anyway, of course, it sounds to me like there's a lot of skullduggery going on there, and somebody is probably on the take. maybe you can't prove it, but, you know, you do not give no-bid contracts to companies. And then, of course, when people raise questions about them, why you target those people, and, of course, this is what happens so often in government, is that there is such a degree of corruption, and the people who try to stand up and do the right thing, are targeted. And, of course, that's why there's some various whistleblower legislation, and it would appear that the Bush administration is doing everything they can to undercut the whistleblower, revelations and the legislation, violating the laws of this land to protect the guilty and, of course, prosecute the innocent. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what happened. There's a, this case documents that, actually. There was a meeting in the Pentagon during 2003 in February, just before the Iraqi invasion. And they were going to decide in this meeting who was going to get a multi-billion dollar job of putting out what they assumed would be the oil well fire that Saddam Hussein's would most likely set once the invasion began. Now, this is a difficult job of getting wells operating again. This project was called Restore Iraqi Oil, or RIO for short. Now, there are U.S. companies that have the know-how about how to put these fires out and get the pumps running again and get the oil production back up. One of these was a Texas-based GSM Consulting, and this is the company that had done much of the work after the wake of the Gulf War. Yet the assumption in the room as they started this meeting was that KBR already had the job.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment.
Yeah.
Well, this is Dr. Stan Mack here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Andrew Skousen. We're talking about the corruption that goes over there, but this, the fact that they're giving very, very favored treatment to certain major corporations that have high connections. And Andrew was talking about the oil well fires. They didn't put this a bid out to the various companies. They had pretty well decided who they were going to give the bid to, who was going to get all these countless millions of dollars. And then, of course, once they got the bid, then, of course, the war came, and there weren't that many fires. So what then? What happened?
Yes, that's a very interesting point.
Did they get their money anyway, whether they put the fires out or not?
They did.
They got their money for putting out the fires, and there weren't any fires to put out, or very few of them. And so this was basically a giveaway of your hard-earned tax money to certain favored people that, of course, are the ones that make the money off of war. The only racket where you count the profits in dollars and the losses in lives. Go ahead.
Yes, well, it's very interesting that at this meeting where they were supposed to decide which company to give it to, there was already a good number of KBR employees in the meeting. What was interesting is that Bunny was very surprised that these contractors were already here, because they had already been paid $1.9 million to draft a contingency plan for how RIO should unfold. And it was strict protocol in the procurement business that any contractor who draws up the contingency plan for a job should not be allowed to bid on the job itself, because he'd know the exact budget, the details about it. He would have an complete unfair advantage about the other companies who are purely bidding without any knowledge at all. And as the participant, as this meeting progressed, it became very clear that that this company would get it, and everyone talked about it as if this was a done deal. And as they reviewed the contingency plan, it became obvious that the only company that met the criteria outlined in the contingency plan was KBR itself. Very convenient, I must say. And to this greenhouse, to her shock, the senior officials and the KBR representatives around the table spoke of this contract as if it was a non-competition contract that could, and this is one of those contracts that would last 5 years. It should be noted that when they...
Hold that thought for just a moment here when we bring our stations back on board.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Andrew Skousen. And, of course, they are holding these meetings, planning on how they're going to put out the oil fires. They're supposed to be competitive bids, but they're not competitive bids at all. They've already made up their mind ahead of time who's going to get the contract. And you're talking about a contract over a five-year period, countless millions of dollars. And, of course, it ends up there are very, very few oil fires. And this company is going to stands to make millions and millions of dollars, really, for doing absolutely nothing. And it wasn't even a competitive situation. So pick up the story there, Andrew.
Yes. I'd like to note that a side note is that when the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, investigated this, well, quote-unquote, investigated this, later, they concluded that the Rio contract was properly awarded, despite the fact that that they had drawn up the initial contingency plan. What they did conclude was that the offer to allow them to do the contingency plan was improperly awarded. So they kind of decided that the small beans was the issue there. Misleading.
Well, of course, the whole thing, they have all these investigations, but the outcome is determined, and you want to give the people the idea that we're trying to get to the truth. Well, all
right.
The time, they're concealing the truth.
Precisely. Now, Greenhouse voiced her reservations about awarding this contract so easily and held out that if the contract was still to be awarded, that it only be awarded for a single year. The next day, though, when the final contract was submitted to her approval, the basic terms were still there. 5 years, non-compete, cost plus. But there wasn't anything else to do. I mean, the country was on the eve of war, and so Greenhouse signed it. Now, this contract was potentially worth, at the outset, $7 billion, just at the start. But, as you say, Dr. Stan, as the invasion progressed and as the U.S. troops did a decent job in their shock and awe technique, that there wasn't much fuel burned. And so there wasn't much for this real project to actually perform by KBR, but they came up with a good solution. The company suggested that it change its job to handling all of Iraq's immediate fuel needs. So they were then put in charge of bringing in the truckloads of gasoline from Kuwait for both military and civilians alike, and they were allowed to do this, which the Corps was fine. But then, as we know, the U.S. troops didn't just leave the country they had just conquered. They had to be stayed. They had to be housed. They had to be fed. And this, of course, meant a lot more opportunity of work for KBR, which already had all these lucrative connections and contracts for troop support that they had earned in the Balkans. And they put this same thing to use here in Iraq. So now they've had all of this money which they've gotten from a non-competition contract, and now they can use the same contract, which was known as what's called cost plus, where KBR could continue to submit bills for whatever it spent, and the government would reimburse it. Not only that, but KBR could inside of this contract add 2% and 7% purely as profit to everything that they billed the government above and beyond the initial amount that they had contracted out. So it's hardly possible to keep track of all of the dollars that came in and out with this, both with the initial amount that they said that they would give them for a service that they didn't perform, and then for all of the services that they said they performed that we're reimbursing them for with a substantial amount of profit tacked on.
Now, my understanding is something like $9 billion has just disappeared. They have no idea where it's gone to, and they're not even really trying very hard. After all,
that's
there's
exactly
lots
right.
of money where that came from.
$8.8 billion that they just can't keep track of.
Oh, gee, shucks.
Yes, convenient for the people who received it.
Right.
And convenient for the connections between the government insiders who have connections with those companies. All right. Well, I think we've talked about that issue to a fair extent. Shall we move on to?
Let's move on to the next one.
All right. Well, I'd like to jump to the end of the World Affairs Brief this time and talk a little bit about Terry Schiavo and the interesting issues that this case brings to light. As most people know, the court upheld the right of the spouse, Michael Schiavo, to make the final medical decisions with relation to his marriage partner, his wife, who was incapacitated. Now, this is a proper decision by the court that the spouse should probably have the final say with regard to this kind of a decision. But we think that there's evidence that Terry's husband was probably not acting in just good faith when he wanted his wife dead. And this is evidenced by his caustic remarks to hospice workers, and also by his adulterous lifestyle that was indicative that he had other agendas that were, how shall we say, inconvenienced by his wife still being alive. His medical witnesses, it's interesting to note, overstated the case about Terry's condition. She wasn't really terminally ill. She had just lost her ability to feed herself through the mouth.
Well, that's because, you know, one of the things, Andrew, I've read that
yeah.
she actually could swallow, but they didn't give her a chance to swallow. They just put that food tube down. Do we know whether she actually could swallow or take food or fluid, you know, independently? I've read something that said she could certainly swallow saliva. She could swallow saliva. She could swallow fluid.
Yes, that's a very good point. That's a very good point. Now, many people wonder about what the appropriate guidelines should be for in this kind of an extreme case. And so we've tried to come up with some general rules of for lack of a better word about this. And that is that when would it be appropriate to keep an incapacitated person alive externally when there isn't a living will by the person dictating otherwise? And we think that there's probably two main criteria about this. One, that the incapacitated person should probably not be put in a long-term position of suffering just with external life support. The other issue, though, is that the costs, when the costs are borne by others, they should be done so voluntarily, so that it's not a condition that a person isn't being kept alive and someone else is being forced to pay for it. So in this case, we think that because the parents were both capable of and willing to maintain the life of their daughter, and given the evidence that the husband was probably not acting in good faith, we think that the court should in fact have allowed the parents to take over legal custody of Terry, and because they were willing to share the burden of Terry's life support, and there's no clear evidence that she was unfortunately, there's a lot of complicated issues with this. I mean, if it's a spouse who wants to get married and he's still tied, does this keep him from beginning a new marriage? If their marriage is sort of being controlled by others at this point, does the artificial life support keep the marriage bond enforced? It's a tough issue, but I think it's important in matters of morals, likely, to revert back to good Christian thought, and I think that those who really honor their marriage covenants are reluctant to divorce an incapacitated spouse who they still love. In this case, I think Michael chose to break his marriage vows by living with another woman who was not his wife. There's some discussion about how much interest he had actually had in keeping his marriage vows together purely for monetary sake. There's some evidence that he was receiving compensation by keeping her alive and she being still his wife. He received some medical compensation for that, and that was one of the reasons why he didn't just divorce her and end his connection to her that way. Going back, I think to the moral argument about this, I think people would do well in these situations to consider the will of God. Although,
well, that's one factor that nobody ever wanted to talk about. Did you notice that? Nobody ever talked about God and his rules and his laws when we're talking about Sherry Schiavo.
That's right. That's exactly right. I think an interesting point that my father came up with is that God isn't always on the side of keeping people alive, however. Occasionally, God is actually for the side of death as often as he is life. Both can serve a godly purpose. Sometimes his will, it may be for the remaining spouse to die. Sometimes we have a tendency to hang on and try to honor quote unquote life here on this earth, which is I think as most of us Christians believe, is just a small portion of our total existence. And sometimes it's best, when it's a spouse's time to die, to allow them to pass beyond and move on to a better eternal existence.
But of course, that was not the issue here. The issue here was the husband wanted to get rid of his wife. There was possibility of her having improved had she been properly treated, and especially when she had a hydrocephalus that was not drained, which should have been drained long before this. But the big thing is, this whole thing was really part of a much larger campaign to get the American people to accept death with dignity. How many times did I hear the attorney for Mr. Schiavo talk about death with dignity? And, of course, this lawyer has been involved in a number of these euthanasia cases, because this is what it was. It was simply legalized killing. And they were trying to use this as a vehicle to convince us, well, who could be against death with dignity? It's not death with dignity at all. There's no dignity in being starved to death, dehydrated to death. But that was the impression they kept trying to give us. The lawyer kept saying, she's comfortable, she's not having any pain. Then we hear she's on a morphine drip. Why are they giving her morphine drip if she's not having any pain? Everything was a lie, and it was covered by the media so beautifully. And the president and his brother both postured and pandered to the Christians. They could have done something if they'd wanted to, and they chose not to do it. But they couldn't let the Christian followers know that, so they had to pretend, well, gee, we did all we could possibly do.
That's exactly right, Dr. Stan. I completely agree with you about this particular case. I was merely commenting that in some cases there might be occasion when it would be appropriate to allow a spouse to pass beyond without keeping them permanently on life support. But that is definitely something that has to be done, you know, with a great deal of prayer, and ending somebody's life is certainly no small matter, for sure. I absolutely agree. In fact, living wills are becoming much more popular with Christians in the recent.
Yeah, but you better read the small print on them, because, of course, if they're talking about extraordinary care, you better have a definition of extraordinary care. And remember, they can always twist words to give them meaning that you never intended. So you have to be so very specific, and you really have to find somebody you really trust to put your life in if you are incapable of making those decisions yourself.
That's a very good point. Did you run into any of these situations during your practice, Doctor?
Yes, I certainly did, and it was always a tough decision. I'll never forget one chiropractor who came in the emergency room at the old county hospital where I practiced. I didn't have anything to do with the case, but the neurosurgeon,
yeah,
after a couple of days, he said, look, he's got bilaterally dilated fixed pupils. We should just let him go, turn off the ventilator. And his wife was a nurse, and his daughter was a nurse, and they said no. And every day the neurosurgeon would come in and say, well, we ought to turn that respirator off today. And
wow.
One of them was there all the time because they knew he would turn it off. And about 2 weeks later, he woke up and went back to practice.
Are you serious?
I'm very serious, yeah. His name was Dr. Robertson. He was a chiropractor and a personal friend of mine. Yeah, doctors should never play God. You never know when somebody's going to recover. Now, I don't know whether Terry Chavo really had the capacity to recover, but I do know that if those CAT scans that they had and Time Magazine were really accurate, that this was gross malpractice. She had hydrocephalus, and they had not drained those ventricles, and they could have and probably have given her opportunity to improve.
No, that's a very interesting point. In fact, one of the articles in the brief this week actually talks a little bit about the caustic treatment towards some of the patients that so-called terminally ill patients receive.
Now, before we're going to get to the end of the program, I want you to get your telephone number out right now so people know how to get the World Affairs Brief.
Yes, if people would like to order a free issue of the World Affairs Brief, they can dial toll-free area code 877-518-5888. That's 1-877-518-5888.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up this evening's program. 877-518-5888. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and right now, of course, we have with us on the line Andrew Scouse. And Andrew, we got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
All right. Well, I'll talk just briefly about this nurse whose name is Mary Therese Heldmuller, who's the registered nurse, and she says this, that if you are admitted to a hospital, especially if you are over 65 or have a chronic illness or a disability, your cases of possibly dying 3 days after being admitted to the hospital are quite high. Some attribute it to old age, but she's found that many of the nurses actually allow people to die and actually cause it to happen. This is called euthanasia. And although it's not legal, it is being practiced, she says. According to last year's New England Journal of Medicine, there was a report that 1 in 5 of the critical care nurses admit to having hastened the death of the terminally ill. This nurse actually believes the percentage is much higher. She has even worked with nurses who admit to overdosing their patients.
And it's hard to believe that this should be going on in America, but you have to realize when we've taken God out of our internal, out of our nursing schools, when we've taken God and prayer out of our schools, when we've taken the Ten Commandments out of the courtrooms, why we should be surprised when some nurses or people working in the hospice would kill people. I know that one of my friends, who was a surgical nurse, told me that he was taking care of an old man at home. He was terminal. And the people from the hospice came by and said, why don't you just give him an overdose of insulin? Well, my friend who was a nurse said, no way, I'm not going to do that. But there are people working within the medical profession today who are angels of death. Why should we be surprised, though? After all, if there is no God, why shouldn't people be able to put people out of their suffering?
Yeah, that's a very important point, Stan, and I think that's a very cogent comment. I think that part of it has to do with the fact that some people see death on a very common basis, and together with the lack of religion in our society, come to disregard life and don't see much problem with hurrying it along a little bit.
And unfortunately, none of us are smart enough to play God. And,
yes.
Time and time again, I would have people I would think that they're never going to get out of the hospital. They're obviously going to die. But we did our best, and an awful lot of them walked out of the hospital.
Yep, and I absolutely believe that you're right, Doctor, that's the correct approach.
All right, we're out of time. God bless you. Thank you so much for being with us, Andrew.
Thank you, Dr. Sam.
Bye-bye. Yeah, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and let me just sort of remind you that we are on a new schedule. If you're listening to our program in the afternoon, why, of course, the shortwave frequency in the afternoon, that's 3 to 5 West Coast, 6 to 8 East Coast, 15.120. That's 15.120. I don't know why they put us there at the end of the of the spectrum, but that's where we are, 15.120, and of course our evening program, 5835, and of course 7426, I guess there is no 7465, were the two frequencies in the evening. So that's 15120 in the afternoon, 5835, and 7465 in the evening, and then of course we point out we do have a four-tape set on euthanasia. And it goes into the background of this planned program to kill off people. And this is really what it's about. You can dress it up in all the fancy names you want to. It's an effort to kill people, the lives that you think are not worth living. Believe me, there are many, many people in this world who are going to go along with that agenda because they think there are too many people in the world. And that's what the Terry Schiavo incident was all about. That's why it was played up so much by the media. I mean, if they didn't want you to hear about it, you never would have heard about it. But they want to establish a precedent. We're a nation of laws, and when the judges say it's all right to kill people, then it's all right to kill people. And I want to say there is a law that's above the law of the judges, and that's God's law. And when we turn against that, why, we're leaving ourselves open for all sorts of problems. Well, you need to get our four-tape set on population control. You need to get our four-tape set on why do we still have cancer. You need to get our four-tape set on genocide and on Laetrile. And you need to get our video, Population Control. You need to get our new video. It's called None Dare Call It Genocide. None Dare Call It Genocide. All of this information will help you better to understand what's really going on in the world today. So that's the four-tape set on population control, the four-tape set on euthanasia, the four-tape set on why do we still have cancer, the four-tape set on genocide. Oh, and probably one of the best tape sets we have, the New Order of the Barbarians. It's a discussion of a talk that was given by Dr. Richard Day, who is the medical director of Planned Parenthood, a talk that was given in 1969. I promise you, you listen to these four tapes, you will never look at the world through the same eyes again. And you get a transcript of those if you want to. It's extra, but you really want to get it, and you want to read it through, and you want to mark it, and you want to underline it. And then you want to see what's happened in the intervening years since 1969. How the plan of what Dr. Day referred to as the order is coming to pass. So all of these items are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a free newsletter, well, I think the November newsletter, which goes into how they're poisoning our children and poisoning our adults by adding hydrofluosilicic acid to the water. 67% of our communities are fluoridated, and of course 90% of those use hydrofluorosilicic acid. What's in it? white fluoride, lead, arsenic, cadmium, polonium-20. You might wonder, why are they adding lead and arsenic to our water? That's poisons, and you're absolutely right. And, of course, if you listen to our other information, you'll know why they're adding it. This is all covered in our November newsletter. We'll be glad to give you a free copy of that if you call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Of course, we hope that you'll want to subscribe to the newsletter, or better still, you really want to help us as we reach out 5 hours a day across America. If you want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and why, we'd love to welcome you. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Our website is radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. You can listen to our archive programs. You can listen to our live programs. And, of course, you can notice we do carry the Berkey products. If you get one of those, you can either get a 4-tape set or a video we produce free of charge. And then, of course, we hope that you'll tell others about our programs. Pull down our newsletters and read them. Pray for America. And so this is Dr. Stan.